Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, a cavalcade of wonderful people, there is Amanda Waltz.
Hello, Brian.
Hello. There's also Nick Newman.
Howdy.
And Will Graham.
Woohoo!
You can't cheer for yourself.
I just did.
All right, well...
I broke
Touché.
You.
We are here after a long break for the holidays to talk about The Hateful Eight, newest film from Quentin Tarantino, out in theaters now. Before we get into that, usual stuff, find us on thefilmstage.com to comment on the pages that these podcasts are posted on. Also, find us on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating. Email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And follow us on Twitter @FilmStageShow. Everybody, how is the holiday break, the Christmas, the New Year's, everything of that nature?
Good.
Besides the tornado.
Oh, that's right. You were around there. I was like, holy shit.
I was like literally a mile and a half, 2 miles away from that area. So.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I was in Houston and it was big news there. And I was like, oh shit, I feel like I know someone there.
Yeah, it was interesting times day after Christmas being with family over at my grandpa's place, all huddled in a closet together.
Oh boy.
Nothing brings the families together like a holiday cyclone.
Wow. Yep. I can't say that my holidays were nearly as harrowing or exciting. So, we did go see Brooklyn, though. We took my
yeah, that's harrowing and exciting.
Yeah, we took the in-laws to see Brooklyn. They loved it. It was a cute movie. It was really sweet.
I enjoyed that movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Saoirse Ronan keeps getting brought up in awards talk, and I think that it's warranted.
I think her name is... So apparently there was a video, I actually watched it, there is a video of her explaining how you actually pronounce her name.
Yeah, it's Saoirse.
It's like inertia.
Yeah, so, like Saoirse. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what I keep saying.
I know, but it was just assholes. Funny because I've been calling her Schwarzy.
Schwarzy?
That's not even close. I actually
heard someone pronounce it that way.
She's from Ireland, not the Ivory Coast.
At one point, I was calling her Saoirse or something like that. And I don't know. I didn't say her name out loud for a very long time because I was only saying it in my head. Because every single time I looked at that.
From Atonement.
Yeah, basically. Well, I didn't even see her. I didn't even really, like, she didn't even make all that much of an impact on me in Atonement. It was, Hannah. And I was like, great. Who the hell is this girl?
Yeah. Who is this kick-ass broad?
She's wonderful. Yeah. Brooklyn was great. I don't know. People, I guess, took issue with the fact that Brooklyn wasn't on our top 50 list.
Really?
I don't think it needed... I mean, it was a sweet movie, but it definitely was not...
I don't know. It ended up... we're not going to talk about that right now.
Yeah, no. Next week, we're going to do our top 10s, just because I'm seeing two movies that numerous people... have said would probably be on my top 10s this coming week. So yeah. I made the command decision to hold us up for my own selfish purposes.
Oh, you haven't seen The Revenant yet?
Nope.
Was that the other one?
The Revenant and Anomalisa.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So we'll be doing our top 10s next week. In the meantime, as we've stated, top 50 is currently up on thefilmstage.com. Mm-hmm. I was so happy. Let's just talk about this for a second. The first thing I did... when Jordan sent out the email, I went through the entire list to make sure that Queen of Earth was not on it. And when I told my fiance, oh, that we're publishing the top 50, she said, ugh, what position is Queen of Earth? And I said, it's not on there. And we both
nowhere
danced.
To be found.
We danced. We danced on the grave of Queen of Earth. Because let's be honest, fuck that movie.
Wow. Okay.
So
strong feels, Brian. Strong start opinions. The new year.
It was a Christmas miracle.
I had a feeling people would forget about it come end of year.
Because it's a terrible movie with no redeeming qualities.
It just seemed...
I remember it the way you remember getting mugged.
Except right. your ears was 2 hours long.
Okay. So okay. You got mugged of $9. How much does it cost to watch a movie in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, no, I got a screener.
I think I got a screener.
Yeah, so I was mugged of an hour and a half. Because let's remember that even though that movie feels like an eternity, it is only an hour and a half long.
Jeez. Okay, let's stop talking about Queen of Earth.
Yeah, let's talk about a good movie. Let's talk about Hateful Eight, the newest film from Quentin Tarantino. This movie is about a number of people stranded during a blizzard at Minnie's Haberdashery in the Wyoming mountains. One of them, a bounty hunter, traversing the landscape with his bounty who he's taking to hang. And the others, a collection of motley people, some of whom, one of whom, none of whom, might be there to try to help break out the prisoner. So, here is the trailer to The Hateful Eight.
What make a man brave a blizzard and kill in cold blood? I'm sure I don't know. You'd be surprised what a man would do. You're starting to see pictures, ain't you?
So The Hateful Eight. This movie has been looming large, I would say, in the cinematic landscape. Shot in 70mm Panavision, subject of a roadshow presentation where 100 theaters across the country retrofitted themselves with 70mm projectors to show this film in an extended form. Guys, did we all see the 70mm roadshow presentation?
I did.
I did as well. My first screening of it was unfortunately the Roadshow DCP because they didn't have a 70mm projector installed yet. But
for the people at home, DCP stands for Digital Cinema Package.
Yeah, and there was nothing different about it except obviously the way it was kind of presented to us. So it was presented in full screen kind of version. Which watching it this time around was quite an experience, having seen it full screen originally and then 70mm the second time around.
Amanda?
I guess I am the exception here.
Oh no!
I did not see it. It's very limited here in Pittsburgh.
Wow. Yes.
So, yeah, I wasn't able to see it.
Why did we let her on the podcast?
Oh, you'll see why you let me on the podcast when we start talking about this movie.
All right. Well, yeah, I saw the 70mm. I got my, in fact, it's right here, my special booklet that they handed out.
Which one did you have?
What do you mean?
Which one's the poster?
Oh, it's Domergue.
Oh, I have Sam Jackson. So.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Damn. I want to find that they're giving out Walton Goggins. Or Tim Roth.
Ooh.
Just going to have to travel the country getting different posters. This begins with an overture. It has an intermission in the middle. Artfully deployed, I would say. So let's talk about it. The Hateful Eight. Nick Newman, you've had the least amount of chatter, so why don't we defer to you? What did you think of The Hateful Eight?
You know, I've had the least amount of chatter on this podcast, but I'm pretty sure I've talked about this film already more than anybody on this podcast because I did write the Film Stages review of it, a very long review. It just ended up being very long because I had quite a lot to say, and I also wrote some capsules for the Best Ensemble, Best Cinematography, and Best Films of the Year list. So with that in mind, you can imagine that I am a fan of it. Now, this is one of those movies that I feel is kind of very... It's one of those instances where each piece is so deeply embedded within the other that to discuss it, it's kind of hard not to just kind of discuss everything around it. Mm-hmm. and to my mind, it's kind of an unqualified success, really, both as another Tarantino take on the Western, to the degree that there are a lot of very kind of peculiarities and manipulations and subversions, but subversions that don't call attention to themselves, that don't announce that they're providing a sort of revisionist Western, which at this point I think has become kind of a tired thing. And also, I think it's a great success as a locked room mystery, which the movie certainly does indulge in, but it doesn't quite indulge in as much as you would think. For a 3-hour movie, it definitely takes its time, and it spends quite a lot of that time with individual pairs of characters kind of locked off into sections of this haberdashery that everyone has been located in. And it takes a lot of time to establish history, both personal and historical, in addition to the sort of ways that they converge. And it does quite a lot to create a tension, I think, in the placement of people in a room and the way that they're cut together, the way that the cutting in this film creates a certain sense of expectation and tension and wonder. Or the way that the certain images will kind of raise suspicions. For instance, I think of when Kurt Russell's John Ruth and Jennifer Jason Leigh's Daisy Domergue go over to Michael Madsen's Joe Gage, there's a shot where the camera is in an upper section of the haberdashery, and the way that it's scanning over them, looking through those own floorboards, almost creates the impression that there's someone else up there observing all of this action. It's a very carefully measured movie. I don't think Tarantino has ever made a film like this that is so dependent on the relation of one shot to the other, because it almost takes place in real time. And part of the fun that he has in that is, I think, exposing what really impresses me about this movie is how I think he's collapsing pretty much all of his major themes into this single room with only about 9 people. There are actually 9 characters in this movie, because there is also James Parks' Obi, who's the stagecoach driver at the beginning, but he sort of gets elided over for whatever reason. And I think that the way that the movie establishes itself early on as a vision of institutional racism and misogyny is clear enough, considering that the first words spoken by Jennifer Jason Leigh to Samuel Jackson involve a certain racial epithet to which Quentin Tarantino has not lost his taste. And immediately after that, she's struck repeatedly. And it's a lot of it is really quite vile. And I know that there was one critic who called this movie actively antisocial, which I think kind of gets at something. But I find it interesting how the conversation has – there have been a lot of instances where this movie has been called racist and misogynist and, in some cases, in the case of one scene, homophobic. And I don't think it's any of those things. I don't think it's I think it is indulging in the horrors of that, but I don't think it's promoting that, and I don't think it's in favor of that.
Well, one person I was reading recently was basically saying the film itself is not misogynistic; it's the characters and the people within the film's reality that are this way.
Precisely, and it's a lot of it is located, not solely, but a lot of it is located when Jennifer Jason Leigh's Domergue was first struck, where the movie basically stops dead. And one of its first real close-ups is of her screaming and writhing in pain as she's been elbowed in the face, and the sound is even punctuated. It's heightened to emphasize the matching of an elbow to the face. And that kind of recurs throughout the movie, and I think that it comes to a head very clearly in its final moments, which are, you know, certainly among the grimmest Tarantino has ever done. I mean, this is the grimmest film he's ever made, and I think part of what makes it so is that it kind of has a lot of the elements of his earlier work, but they're sort of perversions and phantoms of what had previously been sort of these vessels of entertainment. I find it interesting that this movie at one point explicitly recalls the climax of Pulp Fiction, between Samuel Jackson and Tim Roth. There are certain shots that he's used previously that recur here, but they've sort of been turned into symbols of destruction and pain and horror. And somehow people, you know, are not immediately taking to this. Amazingly, this is not to everyone's liking. But for me, I was happy to indulge in it, particularly in the 70mm presentation, which I think does a really effective job of creating a landscape of gestures and facial expressions and movements. This is a very kind of stagey movie in a way, and I think that it does quite a lot of favors to its actors and how all that is communicated. So anyway, before I ramble on much further, I am a great fan of this motion picture, even though I think it is, in a lot of ways, a very troubling one.
Before we go too much further down the line, how did everyone – I mean, we already went over how everybody saw it, but I've heard a couple of people saw the Roadshow format in a smaller screen, because obviously the Weinstein Company has retrofitted a lot of these screens and theaters for these. So I saw it on a fairly large screen. How did y'all end up seeing it as far as the screen itself is concerned?
I would say mine was medium sized. There's a refurbished movie palace in DC called AFI Silver, and it's got like one of the biggest screens and everything. So I'm hoping to go there and see it again. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I saw it in like a AMC multiplex thing.
I saw it at the Village East in New York, and they showed it in the main theater, which is really rather large. It actually is outfitted like an old movie palace, which kind of contributes to the whole overture intermission.
Yeah, that's nice. Why I want to go to AFI Silver for that kind of feel.
Yeah, I watched it in a very intimate, small, independently owned, one-screen theater called Roadhouse Cinema that just opened in Pittsburgh 2 years ago, which was an interesting experience considering like how grandiose this film is supposed to be.
Whoa.
So,
that sound that people might be hearing is apparently the fan on Amanda's computer.
I'm sorry.
So if it explodes...
It's done that before, and I'm surprised that you haven't heard it before. I don't know what it is about this.
Did you mic it?
No. Absolutely. Why would
I've never heard this before.
Yeah, it's happened before. I don't know why you're suddenly hearing it.
I don't know. It's very weird.
Here, give me 1 second.
Okay. Well, while Amanda fucks around with that, Bill Graham, can you tell us what your thoughts on The Hateful Eight were?
Sure. So, first off, I'm with Nick. I'm a little flabbergasted by the very divisive nature that this film has kind of garnered as far as reactions. I guess maybe that's kind of plays into the fact that it's obviously a 3-hour film, and you know, it's very grandiose, and it's Quentin Tarantino being as much Quentin Tarantino as he possibly can throughout the film, to the point where he actually does voiceover work at one point, and you know, he's very obviously breaking the wall or fourth wall with some of his character placements and things like that. He certainly sets up expectations that you might come in with. The fact that it's shot in 70mm and largely takes place, I'd say, you know, 4/5 of the film is indoors, with characters simply talking to each other. It's a film that kind of sets up an expectation that he is neither interested in delivering nor concerned about it all that much. He's very obviously having a lot of fun. And the film feels like a play, and from what I heard, some of the background of it was that was his full intention, was that he wanted this to feel like it was able to be a play and you know, have these characters kind of be larger than life, and the audience kind of almost interacting with them, how close they are, and just the way it was shot is obviously like a play. The 70mm kind of format helps give some certain shots in the film a very wide fish angle kind of view of the whole haberdashery. And I really enjoyed a lot of those kind of aspects, especially on second watch. I think for as indulgent of a film as it is, he's still smartly playing on a lot of themes and things that have kind of woven its way throughout his history of films. And he's giving us a few characters and a few, you know, key touches that I think really will kind of stand the test of time. Walton Goggins in particular is absolutely fantastic here. It's really Quentin's first use of him as a main character. I mean, he was in Django a little bit, but this one he obviously found an actor that I think he's quite in love with. One thing I did kind of want to touch on is, so the main antagonist, I guess, in the film is Jennifer Jason Leigh's and I can't remember her name right now.
Daisy Domergue.
Yeah, Domergue. And
great name.
She's her backstory is not very fleshed out, and I've heard a lot of criticisms about where her story ultimately ends up. And I thought it's interesting, especially on a second watch, seeing how the audience specifically reacts to the abuses handed her way. Like Nick was mentioning, you know, a lot of people have claimed that the film itself is misogynistic, and I think it's weird because I know when I first saw it in my critic screening, everybody laughed the first time she gets hit. And it was a weird moment because it was like, obviously Quentin Tarantino is known for kind of having slapstick and being a very dark humorist. And so I think a lot of the critics read it in that direction initially. And, you know, as the film goes along, I think that becomes a little bit less funny. And I don't know. There's just a lot going on in this film, whether it's like the Ennio Morricone soundtrack, which I found fantastic. I think he's definitely doing some great work, versus, you know, like Star Wars with John Williams, and he basically turned in a shrug. I think Ennio's definitely doing some great stuff here, even if it mainly is kind of one theme that's running throughout the film. It was hard for me to pick out where his score kind of stopped and maybe another track started or things like that. But overall, I think the presentation and just the way it is it's quite entertaining. I've seen it twice, and I know it'll be interesting to see how it plays out now that it's kind of in a larger format with, you know, more theaters and more people have access to it finally.
All right. Well, I always go last. So let's pay off Amanda's cryptic comment from earlier. Amanda Waltz.
Okay. How's that fan doing? Can you still hear it?
No, we can't.
Okay, good. I can't.
I'm the one who matters. So what did you think of The Hateful Eight?
So I just want to start off by saying I am a Tarantino fan.
Uh-oh.
I have enjoyed all of his films to some degree. So
yeah,
I really hated this movie.
Okay.
Like, to a degree that actually disturbs me. I was disappointed in Tarantino. I was disappointed in the Weinstein Company. I was disappointed in myself for actually paying money to support this film. The only good thing that came out of it was that the money is going towards a privately owned theater, because that's where, like I said before, I saw this movie. And then I recycled the beer I drank during this film after it ended. So those are two good things that came out of this. Otherwise, I found this to be torturous, grating, puerile, exploitative pap. It is horrible and excruciating in so many ways. I can't even begin to, like, list them off. I just really didn't like this. The whole misogyny aspects, the race, like you were saying before, I think Bill and Nick touched on this. To say Tarantino is indulgent is like, well, no duh. That's sort of like his thing. That's the foundation of most of his films. I don't mind that. I think that his previous films were very much these sort of gratifying, violent fantasies. So you have even Death Proof was in its own way sort of like a grindhouse feminist fantasy where you had these three women going after Kurt Russell, who's this, you know, serial killer who kills off women. I don't know. I just found there wasn't one redeeming thing in this movie. I really think, honestly, that this is a cruel joke pulled on audiences. Because, okay, you have this film shot in glorious 70mm, mm-hmm. a format that hasn't been used in decades, to watch projectile vomiting. Not just projectile vomiting, but projectile vomiting blood. One of which is into Daisy's face. I did not enjoy watching that. And I love violent, like I've said before, I love torrents of blood. I love violence. I mean, The Guest was like my top movie last year.
Yeah, that had a lot of over the top violence, yeah. In that kind of way.
Still haven't seen that movie.
Oh, it's so good.
I know. I've heard.
But I actually, yeah, I just think that everything that made Tarantino's previous films good are just non-existent here. Of course, he's known for having these long strings of dialogue that not a lot of filmmakers can do that. They can't sustain long exchanges between characters the way he does. And here, they're just tedious. They're just lacking in any and all impact. I think the politics presented here are very childishly presented and very simple-minded. I am at a loss as to, I don't know. I just didn't enjoy it at all. Like, it just seems like he filmed it in 70mm knowing that people were going to go see it for that reason. And then is almost like punishing them for going to see a format as opposed to a film by giving them this. That's the only conclusion I can come to. I don't know. I'm seriously at a loss. And I just saw this film tonight a couple hours ago. And I honestly really don't know what to say. Like, it's just so much here that I can't even like wrap my head around as to what the appeal of this movie is. Like Tim Roth, I don't even know the acting. Tim Roth seems like he's just a Christoph Waltz surrogate.
I noticed that. Yeah, I noticed that very heavily the first time.
I don't agree with that statement.
He's playing it like a Christoph Waltz character. I honestly think that
that's reductive.
Nobody?
I don't know, man.
Hold on.
I didn't hear what Nick said. Nick, what did you say?
Let's not restage the Battle of Baton Rouge.
His voice inflections were definitely Christoph Waltz-esque.
He's...
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to disagree and wait my turn.
I just can't. I just thought it was ugly and cruel for no reason. I think Nick said it's very grim, and I think that is an accurate reading of it. I think there's no redeeming characters here. All the redeeming characters, I think maybe OB might be the only redeeming character.
Yep.
And even he is like barely present. But it just seems like, oh, these are all bad people that you cannot wait to die. That you just can't wait until they're dead.
Hmm.
It's okay. Yeah. They're misogynist. They're racist. And they're all going to die. Good. Thank God.
I'm going to use this as a means of segueing into my review and why I like the movie. Amanda, you said they're misogynist. They're racist. Allow me to add, they are America.
Yeah. Who like, gives a shit?
That's what this movie is like about. It's about the wounds and the battles that have made America what it is today. I mean, like, you see these people being so racist and so hateful, and you think, oh, thank God that we're out of that stage. Because this takes place maybe like 10 years after the Civil War. And then you walk outside and you see the news and you're like, oh, right, that's still happening. Like, we keep telling stories that like Reconstruction and the Civil Rights era like helped. But all of these archetypes that we see in this film are still here, and they're still enacting these same patterns. Obviously, Tarantino heightens it, but it's real, and it's raw, and it's there. And I like that this movie has the courage of its convictions to not give us, like, a magical Negro or, like, an enlightened white person. And I love that. I loved every scene of dialogue. I told a friend that this is, like, the first scene of Inglourious Basterds stretched out for 2 hours, and then the last hour is like Kill Bill and the Inglourious Basterds in terms of like violence and revenge fantasy.
Mm.
It's great. I love this movie.
I think
and people keep talking about the 70 millimeter and it's squandered being used indoors. I disagree. Like, this movie is so beautiful, and the level of detail and the staging that you get from shooting this beautiful wide aspect deep focus in this close quarters area, it just can't be overstated like how much that does for the story and your understanding of space and these characters. Nick, you were going to say something?
Oh, well, if I may jump in here, I think it is. I don't think Amanda is wrong, really, in anything she said necessarily.
Don't think so either.
I think it's. I mean, not. It's also her opinion, so you know, the question of can it be wrong is a whole other thing. But I would say that. Rather, I would say I don't know to what degree I disagree with her. It's more a matter of how you take it and how you read the movie's intentions, I guess.
Its intentions. I understand what it is trying to portray, but there's no mystery there.
But how you react to its intentions, I would say.
No, I understand that. And I know I have gotten on Brian before about being overly angry about films.
Oh yeah, I was about to say playing
and giving it power. I understand that,
Amanda.
I know. I understand that, and I 100% I am taking, but I, oh boy, you guys, I can't.
Anyway, as I was saying, one thing I was thinking of, one of my favorite movie quotes of all time is from the Jean Renoir movie, The Rules of the Game, where one character says something. It's one of my favorite movie quotes, so obviously I can't remember it exactly. But one character says to the other something to the effect of, that's the terrible thing about life, is that everybody has their reasons. And I think that this is... I think Tarantino is very interested in people's reasons for doing things. I mean, I love how Kill Bill, for instance, basically breaks apart 3 hours into its four-hour runtime, and it reveals itself as a movie about the insane things that love compels people to do. Or how Django Unchained is kind of, I think, a 2 hour, 45 minute working of the line from The Godfather. It's not personal, it's strictly business. This is something that he really has a fascination with, and a lot of it comes through concealment. And so for me, the process of watching terrible people be terrible and do terrible things is one thing, but I guess my way into the movie was the pockets of sympathy that he creates for these people, in the sense that because of the confinement that this movie thrives on, I think it is illustrating that in this kind of world, you are so locked off and you are so often going towards people who are going to validate you and who are going to understand you and converse with you in a way that you can do fluidly. Because if you think about it, in this movie, what is the first thing that Walton Goggins' Chris Mannix does is he sees a Confederate general and he goes over to him and he starts talking to him. They start trading war stories. That's the kind of world that this movie exists in. And the way that they can break from that, I found very compelling, in part because it's going to end so badly for them. So for instance, you have here's something that's kind of interesting to me, is that this was originally written as a sequel to Django Unchained. And Samuel Jackson's Major Marquis Warren was originally Django, who just happens to get picked up by this stagecoach on a mountain. Now imagine if it was the same character. Just imagine for a second that it was the same character. And he kills a Confederate general, but it's not entirely justified in the case of this movie. I mean, I feel like there's something to that, which is that I think because Tarantino likes to write similar characters from film to film, he can kind of find ways to work out the ugliness and the wrinkles and the complexities of these things. So in this movie, you have Samuel Jackson tell Bruce Dern's character.
Are we going to spoil something?
Oh, okay. I won't spoil too much. I'll just say that the climax of the movie's first half is a pretty objectionable display from one side, but it's from the side of the black bounty hunter. It's not the Confederate general. And I was very compelled by that because I just wasn't quite expecting that. And it's really rather simple ultimately, but it's one of those things where you kind of understand understand the position of the ostensible bad guy in that scenario, why he reacts the way he does. And the movie is kind of filled with that from stem to stern for me. And it climaxes with the ending of the film, which again is this, to me, is kind of this look towards the future, a very kind of, I would say unsubtle way of encapsulating a certain style of American institution, but is nevertheless something that I found very powerful. So again, long way of saying that I think the extent to which you're supposed to enjoy it is up for debate. I think if you can revel in it, then good. If you can't, then yeah, you're going to have a tougher time with it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the sympathy thing was lost on me. I felt no sympathy toward any of these characters. I couldn't wait for them to die. If a meteor hit that saloon, man, that would have been great.
I'm imagining that right now, Amanda and I could share a perfect dream if all of these characters and all of the characters from Queen of Earth got together and just spent 2 hours murdering each other.
Oh, Brian. Oh, like a terror dome? Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
It would be perfect.
Unfortunately, it's written and directed by Alex Ross Perry.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Brian.
Fuck. I came so close to that being the best movie of all time, and then you just ruined it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess I'm just going to pick up my personal reaction. I don't even remember what I was going to say. I don't know. Amanda's wrong. This movie's great. End of story. I mean, we kept sidetracking me.
Brian. I'm like the Jennifer Jason Leigh to your Kurt Russell.
Yeah, I keep just trying to get my thoughts out there, and you keep spitting and using the N-word, and now I have to punch you in the mouth.
Ruining your good time while you're trying to read that Lincoln letter.
Yeah.
Fucking Lincoln letter.
Good Lord. All right. I love that. I will say that I quite enjoyed the acting on display here. I love Tim Roth. From the moment he walked on, I didn't think at all of Christoph Waltz in his portrayal of this weird, weird English hangman. I mean, like, Bruce Dern was delightfully weird and very understated. There's a flashback that happens at some point. I thought that Zoe Bell was quite winning.
And no, I love Zoe Bell in anything.
No, okay. She's the worst in this.
Oh, fuck off, Bill.
Oh, I will.
Do you
think,
really believe that?
I kind of agree with you, Bill, but I'll also watch her in anything.
No, I absolutely adore Zoe Bell. She does not need to be in this movie at all.
It's funny because I read the, because I'm a bad person, I read the leaked screenplay about 2 years ago, and it said, it was, I think her name is Six Horse Jody or something.
Yeah.
And it said a cowgirl from New Zealand, and I went, oh, well, yeah, let's guess who's going to play her.
Yeah.
Exactly.
She does feel totally shoehorned in.
I do have something to say about that specifically,
please,
but.
Can I finish?
Sorry, Brian.
Anyway.
No, go ahead, Nick.
No, it relates to spoilers, so.
Oh, okay. Well, put a pin in it.
All right.
Ah, fuck. I had something to say, and. Okay,
you should,
all right.
You should write some stuff down.
I should. I can get through it without everyone interrupting me, but this time, I guess, no one gives a shit how I feel. So, what I was going to say is that I love that I hated everyone in this. I love that. Every single person is a fucking monster. But I also love that, you know, during the point that Nick was talking about, at the climax of the first half, I did feel earnestly bad for the Confederate general. I felt bad for a lot of people who've done a lot of bad things. And you start off loving John Ruth, who's played by Kurt Russell, and Major Marquise Warren, who's played by Samuel L. Jackson. And the more you learn about them, the more you grow to be disgusted by them. Like, this movie does the thing that I love most in all fiction of this type, which is you have this moment where two characters are talking and they're kind of friends, and then another one comes in and does the, oh, did he not tell you about this? And then goes into, like, a big speech about this person and some hidden thing from their life. And I don't know why that's one of my favorite tropes, but it is. And this movie has that for literally every character. It's like, oh, he told you this. Well, did he also tell you this? 5 minutes of explanation about something terrible that person has done. It was great. And it kept you teetering to the point where you didn't really like anyone. You just had to kind of root for the people who at least showed the possibility of humanity. Unlike other certain characters who are completely irredeemable. Now everyone can interrupt me.
Oh, Brian.
What are you O'Brien-ing about?
I just can't. I just think you're just such a masochist.
Look, I have burned myself with cigarettes. I have cut myself with knives. You know, I've stood in a frozen river. I may be a masochist, but I think this is a good movie.
I think this film is very interesting because I have a number of good friends that saw it recently, and they despised it probably about as much as you did, Amanda. And
oh, I love your friends.
it was so interesting because I think this is, you know, I mean, saying a film is divisive is kind of an easy out, right? For
right.
Basically being like, okay, I'm going to lavish praise or lavish hate on this film, and you know, you may have a completely different view, but I've never witnessed it as much as this film, even though it's barely been out in, you know, a wide release at this point.
And let me just tell you, you think I'm overreacting? My husband was spitting out hyperboles like nobody's business after this movie.
Oh, that sounds like me after I saw In the Heart of the Sea.
Oh, boy, man. He was so angry that he was like, I won't ever watch another movie with any of these people. He's like, Channing Tatum, never.
Wow.
Never. He was like, I will go out of my way to not watch movies filmed in 70mm. He was so irate.
That's far be it for me to use hyperbole, but that's goddamn crazy, and you should probably commit him to a hospital.
He was. This movie drove him to just hysterics. He was so angry that it actually made me a little sane.
That's even I am such a weird response because I feel like this movie is Tarantino mainlined for the Tarantino fan.
I I don't feel that. I think somebody actually, a former editor of mine went on an epic Twitter rant about this movie. And he actually called it gold-plated version of Grindhouse. And I kind of agree with him. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It just feels like he's just like let loose to a degree that
he's beautiful.
He's lost all sense of himself. He's lost all sense of what his movies are even trying to accomplish. I thought the whole mystery aspect of it was clumsy at best. I mean, there was no tension whatsoever. I felt no tension.
Are you serious?
I felt not a single ounce of tension during this movie. Hmm. Probably because I just wanted everyone to die. And I just wanted the experience to be over with.
Okay, because I don't know if it was tension or curiosity, but I couldn't wait to see where this was going.
Oh, man. Yep. Nope.
I was there with you.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Not a single second. Not a single moment. I just was like, when is this going to end?
did at least when John and what's her name? Daisy get knocked out of the stagecoach, did you at least laugh at that?
No. Why would I laugh at anything that happened in this movie? None of it was funny.
What? So much of this... All right, you know what?
We're going to have to get into spoilers.
Yeah, we're going to have to get into spoilers. I was just going to say, I personally found so much of this movie witty and clever and funny. I guess, you know, as with all things, you're going to have to choose who your tastes align with more and listen to them. But that's going to be weird because I feel like, Amanda, you and I, our tastes align pretty often.
Yeah.
And here we are at an impasse.
We are. I don't know, man.
I don't know.
I don't know what to tell you. Sorry I can't be your ally on this one. But apparently you have two other allies.
Yeah, it's not like Queen of Earth. You know, I don't need to be defended. So
I'm the dissenting opinion, as I was on It Follows. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you, man.
It's fine. Let's get into spoilers then. So if you haven't seen this film, clear 3 hours out of your schedule. Get out there, go see it in 70mm at the best theater you can find, and enjoy. Get a what are they called?
Poster.
The book. Yeah. Get the book and tell us what poster you got. Send us a picture. I literally didn't know that there were different posters you could get. All right. So spoilers. Everyone dies.
I stuck my whole black dingus down his throat. All right, anyway.
So many things.
Is this the first 70mm blowjob in film history?
I don't know.
Hmm.
Was there a blowjob in The Master?
No, there's a hand job.
There's a very angry hand job. Very angry.
In The Master?
In The Master, yeah, there's like the angriest hand job on film.
I thought it was just a masturbation scene where he's like masturbating into the ocean.
No.
Pranking his dog
right
into the
Amy
ocean.
Amy Adams is jerking off Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And she's telling him like all the things that he's going to do from this point on in his life and how he's going to be like separated from Joaquin Phoenix and is just like just grimacing and growling at him the whole time. And you're just like, okay.
I will say that the masturbation into the ocean scene is also perhaps the angriest masturbation on film.
It looked painful.
There's a lot of sexual anger in The Master.
Yikes.
To segue back, also some sexual anger in this film. As when there's a very long scene where Samuel Jackson talks about how he was able to sexually assault and rape the Confederate general, played by Bruce Dern, his son, and then murder him.
Which, of course, could be a complete and utter red herring just to... Yeah.
Yeah. It's possible, because he was trying to provoke him to pick up a gun so he could shoot him. And it worked.
Right.
It doesn't change the fact that we get to see some of it.
Yeah.
In fact, I love that in the trailer, they have, like, Samuel Jackson's mischievous, "You're starting to see pictures now, ain't ya?"
Yeah.
And that is from that scene.
I just remember, I saw this movie with Jordan Raup you know, founder of the site. And
who?
Our benevolent lord and master.
We both...
Oh my gosh, Amanda.
I'm so sorry. I have it on a towel right now to try and...
You have it on a towel?
Yeah, I'm just like, I don't know how to muffle it. I'm sorry.
Probably smothering it. It's getting super hot, and that's why the fan has to come on.
Just the mic.
I don't know what to tell you. I'm switching computers. This will not happen last week.
Okay.
Or next week.
It's fine. It's funny. It's funny. It's a shtick. Nick, what were you going to say?
You can attest that I saw this at the first press screening in New York, so people really did not know what to expect from this movie because it wasn't even like advanced word.
Right.
And so there was a very kind of startled, confused laughter during that whole sequence. I think particularly spurred by the intense close-ups of Bruce Dern's face as he's being told this story, superimposed with the act itself. If I remember correctly, that's how it's presented, right?
Correct.
There's some superimposition going on.
He's like a child, he's like a child cowering under a blanket, thinking there's like a monster under his bed.
Yeah.
Basically.
How I would describe it.
And, you know, the thing about that sequence, which I think is more than it being an objectionable act on Samuel Jack's or Major Marquis Warren's part, what I think kind of counts most is that the division of this movie, the structuring of it, makes it so that basically you're allowed to see how this very kind of grandiose, bombastic act is exactly the sort of thing that cannot be happening in this kind of situation. And I find it interesting that the moment when the movie becomes most, quote-unquote, cinematic – with its swelling music and its close-ups and its superimpositions and these big landscapes is precisely when the most malevolent act of the movie is being committed in the background, which is the poisoning of the coffee. Mm. And I don't know. I found that very fascinating. And for me, a lot of the movie's morals are centered in that moment, that sort of while people are participating in these grand displays and getting into these conflicts of racial difference and anger and hatred and violence, there are even more malevolent things going on in the background. And, you know, one thing I like about it is the fact that Tarantino himself tells us that this is happening, how he has his voiceover, and, you know, he seems to take a giddy pleasure in it, which I think contributes to the movie's sense of sadism, which is certainly something that people can object to. But, yeah, I don't know. Overall, I think that's it's a very tricky sequence, and the fact that it closes the first half is very telling. But I also just love that sequence's use of atmosphere and how it makes the playing of a piano as important to the sequence as the telling of a story, and how that sequence is as much about setting a scene and creating an environment and being part of an experience as it is the actual narrative momentum of it. Mm. So,
that's, I remember specifically the fact that the film takes its intermission right after that moment where he shoots the general is so key, because I think the whole film has been building and building and building, and we finally get action, and it's at that moment that he decides to take a break for 15 minutes. And I remember getting out of the critic screening and talking with some friends and basically saying that this feels like it's the top of the roller coaster, that we're about to just be dropped right into the middle of something. And sure enough, pretty much all hell breaks loose from that point going forward.
And it's beautiful.
I wanted to bring one thing up that my friend Mark Walters, local Dallas critic down here, actually mentioned after the film, and I thought it was an interesting reading of just, you know, kind of surface level stuff that was going on. And he was mentioning the fact that there's a very thing or the thing kind of commonality that is played throughout the film, whether it's obviously the snow, whether it's obviously things like Kurt Russell, whether it's them constantly trying to figure out who the bad guy in the film is.
Well,
it's funny
because you don't. None of these characters have a reason to believe that one of these people isn't who they say they are. Mm-hmm. And Kurt Russell's immediate suspicion of all of them initially comes off as a little crazy.
Sure. Yeah.
And yet, as we learn, he's 100% correct about all of them. Because there's not just one turncoat. Literally everyone who was there was there to help set that woman free.
And I also wanted to touch on something that that Nick was mentioning about kind of having all the reality of our present world is that, we can be very secluded from people with varying degrees of opinion and things like that. It's very easy to be Facebook friends with just a select few kind of, people that have a similar train of thought and surround yourself with people in that same kind of idea. And I thought it was interesting that he points out that the film definitely does that, where it has these little pairings that, people will go off and kind of, sit by each other, or they just kind of orbit around each other. And at one moment, Samuel L. Jackson goes over to talk to the general, and as soon as he gets anywhere close to the general, Walton Goggins immediately pops up and accuses him and says, what are you doing? Don't be causing any trouble. And it's kind of one of those moments where it's like, the simple idea being played out there is that these two couldn't possibly have anything to talk about and get along with. And yet, in a way, they kind of do before Samuel L. Jackson decides to obviously tell this intensely graphic story and make him reach for his gun.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's I'll also say that there is, for me, an incredible amount of tension, especially given the fact that up until like the final moment of this film, I was intensely curious and worried about how the film would end. There's a very anyone could die at any moment type of mentality to this film that I think, unlike a lot of films that go for that, actually pays off.
Yeah. Also the fact that that there's such an emphasis on pain and suffering in this movie that I was really shocked by, particularly as it relates to Samuel Jackson, who has always been, well, certainly not in the case of Django Unchained, but has nevertheless always been the, if not the hero of Tarantino's films, when he's in them, he's very much a central presence, and you want to keep watching him. And even in the case of Django Unchained, it's not until the very end when he's killed horribly. In this case, though, there's quite a distension of, and I think that's the key word, is distension of his particular injury, which is also, funny enough, is pretty much directly a callback to Inglourious Basterds, because a lot of people forget that Michael Fassbender's Archie Hickox gets shot in the testicles. As does another Nazi there, but they sort of die instantly. There isn't that focus on the suffering, but here it's just so drawn out. It's literally drawn out with the slow motion, which makes it a particularly awful experience.
Yeah,
the slow motion.
What was that?
I hated that slow motion. Oh my god, I can't even tell you how much my eyes rolled back into my head. It was like I was looking at my brain. It was so.
No, I loved that slow motion and the way it tracked the gunshots between Walton Goggins and the remaining gang members was great.
But here's the thing. Okay, so
okay,
all of these characters are terrible people.
Yep.
But I think in Tarantino's previous films, even the terrible characters had a sense of charm about them. Going back to Christoph Waltz, I would even say he's, of course, a horrible Nazi. You love watching him. You love watching him just be very sinister, like, just that, I don't know, there's just that quality that's missing from any of these characters. Or even in Jackie Brown, you see Samuel Jackson, who's basically just a mean son of a bitch. You like him because he's just such a... There is a quality about him that you can't deny liking. I just think that's so absent from this movie. I didn't find any of these characters at all charming or likable in any way. I just didn't find them appealing in any way. And I think that it's set up from the very beginning. And right off the bat. I don't think... I didn't even like Kurt Russell's character.
Oh, I hated Kurt Russell's character.
And I think you're supposed to look at him as being at least somewhat noble.
No, I would say there's nothing in the movie to defend.
You know, the thing is, I'm sorry that I keep jumping in to just say, well, if you look at this scene, but we haven't discussed.
That's fine. We're here to talk about the movie.
The thing is, no, I find it weird that there's been very little discussion of one scene in particular that I think is easily the most beautiful scene in the movie, which is when Daisy performs Jim Jones at Botany Bay on a guitar. Mm-hmm. And again, this is why, as I talk about my review, I think that the movie's not necessarily sympathies, but its heart, whatever that counts for in this instance, lies with her and Warren, is because those are the two characters who the movie really stops for. And in that instance, it's a single thick shot of her just playing the guitar, singing this song, kind of in her own world, enjoying herself in a state of contentment. And it's a beautiful moment. And how does it end? It ends with John Ruth saying, "Music time's over," picking up the guitar and smashing it in the most brutish, thug-headed way. And to me, that's a pretty clear sign that we're not supposed to really have sympathy for him. I think it's a funny moment. I did enjoy the moment in the moment. But as for the
comedy are very different, Nick.
I love that moment. I love that moment because, yeah, it's exactly right. It's this quiet, nice little moment that's going on, and he just snaps it in half. And
I don't like her either. That's the thing. I don't care what happens to these people.
See, well, I don't necessarily think that we're saying anything different about what your kind of reaction to the film is, because I don't think any of us really like these characters either, but there's a difference between necessarily rooting for them versus being fascinated by their horribleness and being fascinated about the way they go about their business. I mean, obviously John Ruth is not set up to be a sympathetic person, and yet Samuel L. Jackson and everybody else throughout the film is constantly calling into question his methods, because he's very obviously the hangman. He literally hangs people. That's his kind of, you know, calling card, is that he doesn't do the easy way, right? He goes for the long and the hard way because
that's
just
what justice is.
That's what I meant by nature. Right, and that's what I meant by him being this, I don't, like, this, he has, like, this principle, like, this way of life that he lives by. I don't fucking care. I don't care about these people. I don't care.
I cared about a lot of them. Towards the end of the film, I especially cared about Chris Mannix, Walton Goggins' character.
Sure.
And
sure.
I think that
he really kind of turns a corner. I think he's got the biggest arc in the film.
Oh, yeah. And I think he pulls it off great. I love him in this movie. He is a virulent racist, and he is part of basically a Ku Klux Klan precursor. And he's, you know, the whole South will rise again, dignity and defeat thing. But he does the right thing in the end. You know, he doesn't turn on Samuel Jackson's character just out of, you know, racial bias. He adheres to what the law should be, because he is a sheriff. It's also hilarious that, you know, a former basic Klan member has been made a sheriff in post-Civil War America. I mean, it's on the nose, but it's the thing. That's true. That's a thing that has happened that basically still happens now. And I love that he manages to stick to the guns and actually, like, overcome the bitter, hateful demons in his heart and do the right thing.
But is it the right thing? That's the thing. How is that the right thing?
Hanging Daisy?
I don't think there's a right thing in this film.
But they don't even see what Daisy's crime is. That's the thing. We have no idea what she's even done.
It's only until the end of the film where you start to realize how capable she is of talking her way out of situations, and obviously she's second in command of this group of thugs that have been trying to rescue her. That's one of the biggest flaws of the film in the way that it sets up this character, that it doesn't have any kind of real follow through on what her actual crimes are and things of that nature. But I mean, there could be said there's a lot that could be said about just the simple fact that he's obviously a very intelligent, smart filmmaker, and I think he doesn't want to tell you why she's such a terrible human being. You're supposed to basically know that John the Hangman Ruth has been doing this for quite a while, and he has zero sympathy for this woman, because obviously she's a very, very bad woman. Whatever she's done, whatever crime she's been accused of, you know,
she's got a $10,000 bounty on her head. I mean,
yeah,
right. And you see how ruthless her gang is, but I can't.
I don't understand. Why you have a problem with her being hung?
No, yeah, I do.
Why?
Because how is that? Okay, so you're sitting there talking about how.
Yeah, I have a problem with her being hung too.
Yeah, because it's very. They are obviously enjoying and wallowing in this act of hanging this woman.
Okay.
Who.
That's their response to it, though. What is your problem with her dying?
I don't really care how anybody. I don't really care that any of these characters die necessarily, but it's just incredible. It's sadistic in a way that just feels like, okay, so are we really supposed to root for these two men in the end?
I don't know.
Because one of them stuck up for the other one and got over his racial prejudices to hang a woman. And like I said, I just feel that this is cynical to the point of just being pointless. Like, it's just so I just don't even understand.
That's the point. Like, you can't, there's no putting away biases and hatred unless you find a new focus for it.
Okay.
Like, that's an unfortunate truth.
That's interesting.
Right, so.
when was America the most united it's ever been? Let's be real.
9/11.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm gonna.
Nick,
I would have also accepted Pearl Harbor. I mean, like, any time that we can see ourselves as a group against a common enemy, that's gonna help us out.
That's the theme of Watchmen. Anyways,
what is
Nick Newman?
Watchmen coming in.
What was your specific? Did you have anything specifically against the hanging of Daisy, or
not on the grounds of it? Only in the sense that I found it revolting, as I think you're supposed to find it revolting.
Right, you're supposed to find it revolting.
Okay. Yeah, and I agree completely with what Brian's saying, because I think that.
Wow, can we just pause and really relish this moment where Nick and I are in agreement?
Can we put it in slow motion?
I think of what there was a Letterboxd review of this movie that I think kind of gets to the heart of it. I'm sure you guys know what Letterboxd is, the site. Anyway, there was a review that said, if there's one thing a bunch of racists and murderers can agree on, it's that you can't trust a bitch. And
yep.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, part of it for me is that I think that part of what makes this so grim is that Tarantino has often had his visions of the powerful woman. I mean, there's a whole, God, what, 12-year stretch of that from Jackie Brown to Inglourious Basterds, really kind of focalized in Kill Bill and the second half of Death Proof. And here, it's not gone. It's just the extent to which the energy is placed. It's the allocation of energy on her part of power. And I think that, you know, part of it for me is just that the whole flashback sequence is really important because it's mostly women who are killed in the haberdashery. And one of the two men who is not killed is only not killed because he doesn't necessarily need to be, because the other man is Minnie's husband. So obviously he's not going to stay quiet during that situation. What's interesting about it, though, is that there is a very kind of indiscriminate quality to the killing, in that they don't care. They don't care that they're killing women, is the thing. All they care about is that they are eliminating people who are going to stand in their way, and they are the criminal element. They are the Domingue gang, as they're referred to for some reason. What, did I miss something? Why does it go from Domingue to Domingue? Was that just a...
Yeah, I wondered that too.
Yeah,
I have no idea about that.
So the thing is, there is definitely a, you know, I think that the way that we are conditioned to view violence, there is an additional horror to it when it's these men gunning down these defenseless women. But what's tricky about it is that the movie is saying essentially that perhaps they are not better, but there is something almost more noble in the fact that they don't care, in the fact that they're not thinking of her as a, they're not thinking of these women as women necessarily. But when you jump back to the present and you have the hanging, I think there is kind of an institutional hatred in there, because it is this former general and bounty hunter, and it is the supposed future sheriff of Red Rock. Mm-hmm. And I think that there, yeah, again, it goes back to you can't trust a bitch. And for me, so it's this, that's what the importance really of the flashback sequence is, driving that point forward. More than just a twist, it's driving forward the point that, you know, sometimes, you know, hatred is a very tricky thing, in that it can be found in aggression, but more sinister is the way that it's found in aggression and a certain...
Well, it could be an unfortunate unifying force. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so is this movie about MRAs, you guys?
This movie's about a lot of things. I highly doubt it's about MRAs.
One thing that Quentin has actually said, because obviously the issue of misogyny has kind of come up, and it's you know, made its way all the way back to Quentin and even Harvey Weinstein, and they both had a lot to think. Well, even Jennifer Jason Leigh came out in support of the film, but one thing that Quentin specifically said was that this film is basically there is a black cloud of violence and death hanging over every single one of these characters. And if he had just simply said, oh, but she's a woman and I can't have her die a gruesome death, it would have felt like a, you know, like a pulled punch, right, in a way. And right. So I think he's obvious. Like I said, I think he's too smart of a filmmaker to be doing these things without intention. I think he's obviously fishing for a reaction from audience. I think he's even testing audiences to see how they react to certain things in this film, because yes, a lot of these things are played for laughs. A lot of these things are played for obviously black comedy or dark comedy, whatever you want to call it. And yet some people have just, you know, point blank rejected it whole hat, whereas other people have, you know, seemingly laughed throughout, and you know, there was a very mixed reaction even at the second the public screening that I went to. Obviously, the film critics that saw it early with me had a, you know, I guess you would call them mostly Tarantino fans, so they kind of knew a little bit of the darkness to going into this film.
Yeah, I've noticed a division in the reactions too among people in terms of how their audience reacted, because I've seen on Twitter a lot of people claiming that the ending is clearly celebrating her demise, because the audience they saw it with were laughing and clapping, whereas on the other hand, such as in my case, when the audience was in this uncomfortable stone silence, a lot of us have kind of said us, like I'm, you know, some faction going on here. A lot of people have said, well, no, it's not, because it's a really horrifying sequence and the movie stresses it as such. So I think it's, yeah, I don't know. That's
the power of watching it with other people, isn't it? I mean, that's why comedy specifically plays so much better in a theater, when everybody's hooting and hollering and having a bunch of fun, because the laughs are just going to hit so much harder.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I find it I don't know. I don't really want to spend too much time with a person who was laughing and cheering at her being hanged with the man's arm, with the man's arm still handcuffed to her body. I mean,
Okay, well, that was, see, yeah, I'm laughing because of
the way that Nick says it, but I didn't laugh when it happened.
I laughed at the arm. Oh.
Well, it's, and that's the thing though, is like you were saying, Bill, he obviously wants to generate a certain reaction from the audience, but I don't know. I felt nothing for this film. I didn't feel shocked. I didn't feel particularly, I don't know. I was completely unmoved by this film, except for the fact that I was angry that I wasted 3 hours of my life watching it. I was completely bored.
Amanda, I really wish that we could parse this and figure out, because I mean, you seem to be in such a state of anger right now that it's hard for you to even put it into words. I can tell you that you're kind of like struggling to kind of formulate opinions and viewpoints on it because you're just damn angry at the movie. So
letting you guys speak and you know,
you're the dissenting viewpoint. You're by rights the most interesting person on this podcast.
It's just a love fest over this film. And I don't know.
Shake it up then.
I don't even know what to say because I just.
I'm so unmoved
by it. I just didn't think the mystery conceit worked at all.
I didn't feel that the mystery conceit was as big of a part of it as you're making it.
But it is, because it's playing on that style, like everyone says. It's an Agatha Christie mystery set in a saloon, and it's just that the way it was set up in
chapters. It's a haberdashery.
It was just, it's a goddamn saloon. How is it a haberdashery?
They sell jelly beans.
Yeah, they sell wares.
Isn't a haberdashery a hat shop?
You can get some of Uncle Charlie's stew. It's got a stable. It's got a place where you can loop your horse.
Here,
a hat in that place.
Haberdashery is the shop of a haberdasher.
Great description.
Are we literally looking this up?
Yeah, I'm looking it up.
One thing that I will forever remember from this film is the door sequence and how it's constantly played out over and over, and it's just this little thing where and they even set it up in the flashback how the door kind of got busted and why it's constantly needing to be nailed shut, not
the
just once but twice. And I love how every single time someone comes in or goes, they have to yell instructions again and again, because you know at first it's just John and Daisy, and then I think OB comes in individually and someone else comes in, and so every single time they come in they're having to yell the same instructions over and over and over.
That's one of the smaller story things that we haven't talked about, because I loved that reveal that, you know, when they first open this door, these three guys are shouting, you know, nail the door shut, you know, the hammer and nails are by the door, you got to use two, one won't hold it. And they really do have the air of people who've been there dealing with this bullshit door for a while, when in reality, it's the first time. And then later on, you have Kurt Russell joining in their chorus, because that's what you would do if you're one of those people.
Well, and even I think it is John is the first one to actually ask, like, what the hell is wrong with this door? And then, of course, you know, Warren eventually, you know, reveals the fact that he's obviously known Minnie's haberdashery for quite a while and that this door wasn't broken, you know, that long ago, you know.
Also, a haberdasher. This is one of those words. I started with haberdashery and now I'm on haberdasher. And it's one of those things that just kind of doubles back on itself a lot. But it says, a person who owns or works in a shop that sells small items such as needle and thread that are used to make clothes, sells men's clothes. And then there's the British version, which is a dealer in notions and men's clothing
what?
Accessories.
Notions?
Notions.
Well.
Which, that, if you've
that,
seen
that
Carol,
nothing. That
you'll know
nothing.
What a notion is. Like, in Carol, there's a character who says he sells notions, and he defines that. For anyone interested, according to Merriam-Webster, a notion is small useful things, such as pins, thread, or buttons, often used for sewing.
Oh, I'm so glad that we covered this.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you, Ryan.
But there's just a lot of clever writing like that. Clever writing that in the case of the actual plot and story is actually clever deception, which is what a story is. So there's another metatextual level that could say all these people are actors, and that crazy British accent that Tim Roth is using is his putting on of a British accent to
deal
with people.
Was there any question at all that he was putting on that accent?
But he definitely wears it for quite a while, to the point where you actually start to kind of think, where is this guy from?
It's
he
just
could
very
just be
obvious
a kooky
that,
hangman.
It's just very obvious that all of those characters, the weird John Ford Mexican type character, who
love him,
the cowpuncher
who looks like he's from a singing cowboy movie.
Yeah. And then you have the effeminate British man. Yeah, it's just all put-ons. Okay, they're all Western archetypes. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Now give me...
I agree, it is
something
great.
I can grab onto.
I mean,
because
in my review, I described it as basically like the waiting room of the Western cinema's purgatory, which is something, which is the thing, though, is that there is kind of a purgatorial quality to this whole movie. I mean, Amanda, it seems like watching this movie was purgatory for you, but
yes.
Otherwise, I enjoyed that aspect of it because, again, you talk about them being actors. This whole movie feels sort of, it feels stage bound, and you know there are these weird things where, because you have Robert Richardson as the cinematographer, so you have the heaviest top down lighting there's ever been inside a stagecoach, where at one point it looks like there's just a light hanging from it.
Well, there's
and
so
I like
many
that,
things like that in the haberdashery, and then it shows them lighting candles, and I'm like, well, where the hell's the other light coming from?
And I like that artificial quality to it, and I also like how essentially I think that, you know, the movie is kind of how would I put this? The thing about the artificial quality of it that I find really compelling is just kind of this the sense of no escape, the sense that this is kind of all there is now. And when you have the howling wind outside, it's almost this extra character in the movie of the weather, of this.
Oh, yeah, the sound design in this is brilliant.
I mean, the sound design in this movie is absolutely wonderful. And it kind of, again, it's about taking small gestures. It's about taking a small space and maximizing it and getting the most out of it, which I think this movie does very effectively through pretty much every possible cinematic means. But anyway,
it's real weird how much you and I sync up on this.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. It's you know, it's like the characters in this movie. We are united against a mad raving woman.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I'm sorry that the joke presented itself. I love
you
Amanda.
Have to take it.
I did not see her as at all analogous to Daisy Domergue.
I think
and
I
Bill
think
in
you,
this case
you...
would be OB, the hapless guy who stumbles in and is still one of the first to die.
Oh, Nicholas.
Anyway.
Oh, Nicholas.
I feel like we I don't want to say we've hit an impasse with this movie, but I think that
I will say I think my biggest issue with this film, besides the fact that it is the worst film of the year.
Jesus, seriously?
That, oh my god, yes. And I saw Entertainment, so let's just... Mm. I don't even... Well, I know you like that, Nick, so...
No, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't? I thought you did like it.
Is that one of those movies that we just assume that Nick would like?
Maybe.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Nick.
Oh, god.
But it's kind of like when I watched the last two films from Wes Anderson, where...
Did you not like those?
Oh no,
Amanda!
Oh,
what God. The fuck is wrong with you?
I hated Grand Budapest. I hated Moonrise Kingdom. Well, I shouldn't say I hated Moonrise Kingdom. I liked the leads in Moonrise Kingdom. Beyond that,
so blown away by this.
Amanda,
why do you hate America's greatest living auteurs?
Because I'm a fucking rebel. That's why. It just, and I think that's the thing with Wes Anderson, where Wes Anderson, Tarantino, obviously, his vision has been so indulged and people have become so taken with so many of his films that he feels he has license to experiment more and do more things with his films. Wes Anderson, in that case, has become much more stylized and much more sort of like wrapped up in his own whimsy, to the point where his films no longer, to me, feel like actual films. They feel like people in costumes acting. People in costumes acting at me.
I thought Grand Budapest was probably his most accessible work outside of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah, and
super ambitious in terms of what he was doing with it. And I think a lot of it, it's like Quentin Tarantino, where he is honoring these, you know, sort of bygone styles of filmmaking, where it's just, you know, and that's great. That's wonderful that you have a knowledge of film and you obviously love film and you appreciate these sort of, I mean, I think in Tarantino's case, it's sort of like these underappreciated styles of filmmaking have been considered sort of like lowbrow for some time. But that's how it feels to me. It just feels like these are people in costumes acting at me.
Well, Amanda, since you don't like ambiguous or unlikable characters and you don't like revisiting old ways of making movies, you know, you're in luck, because in 2 weeks we'll be able to talk about 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi by Michael Bay. So we'll have the most current cinematic auteur with some truly unambiguous American heroes.
I'm looking just forward for to you. That. Hey, let's just say I can walk both sides of the fence.
Yeah, Nick?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
I'm actually really looking forward to 13 Hours. It's got James Badge Dale in it.
Yeah.
I have the biggest crush on James Badge Dale.
Anyway.
Did you watch Rubicon?
No, I didn't. Was it good?
What?
I guess I should see it. Have you started watching The Leftovers yet, Bill? You want to talk about that?
Yeah, Bill.
Not yet.
Mm-hmm, all right. Maybe you should check the attitude next time. All right. Well, I think we've come to the end of our discussion.
Well, you guys have just thoroughly lynched me, haven't you? it's so funny when the lady says it isn't. Oh,
hey, Amanda, so did you not find Channing Tatum the least bit charming in this film?
Oh, fuck Channing Tatum.
I loved him in I loved how summarily he was dispatched.
You know what? No, I don't even want to talk about this movie anymore.
Right.
I want to forget this movie ever happened to me.
Well, that sucks.
One of my few complaints.
I'm just going to bring it up every time.
One of my few complaints, they shouldn't have put his name in the opening credits, because
I know.
I knew he was in this and I knew exactly who he was playing, but I still feel like, you know.
I didn't know he was in it until I saw his name, and I didn't know who he'd be playing.
Yeah, they didn't need to have Zoe Bell's name. They didn't need to have his name. They didn't need to have anybody that wasn't introduced, you know, within the first 20 minutes of the film.
Or the first 2 hours.
True.
True.
Yeah.
Again, I just think Zoe Bell is just
delightful.
Huge sore thumb in this movie.
What is up with her precious... I don't know, just her dancing around and being
her injection of whimsy in comparison to the anger and hatred of everyone else.
Oh my God, Brian, I just can't. I
hated her. I hated
you
her.
Know what? You know what, Amanda? You don't fucking have to, because we're ending this podcast.
Yes, we are. Yeah, we fucking are.
So
next week we're doing
Top 10. Yes. And then shortly after that, maybe we'll try to make it a double week. We'll be talking about The Revenant as well.
We should also talk about Carol.
And Anomalisa.
Did you Wait, who saw The Revenant and liked it?
I have not seen it yet.
Okay.
I saw Carol and I thought it was fine.
Oh. That's not what I got from your
letterbox?
I don't know, Brian.
What do you mean? What?
Oh, you said it was fine.
Yeah. What do you think I said it was?
Yeah. I don't know.
Super confused right now.
No. Well, no. Okay. Who saw The Revenant and liked it?
I don't know. A lot of people. It's got a pretty good rating.
No, but among you three gentlemen.
Oh, I haven't. No, I haven't seen it.
I've okay. seen it.
Okay.
I. Yeah, are you waiting for me to tell
Sorry,
you that I liked it?
Because
I did not.
I'm asking a very simple question.
Well, you keep asking who saw it and liked it, and I don't fit that description. I saw it and did not like it.
Thank you, Bill.
So I didn't know answer to your question, Amanda, is literally no one.
No yes. one saw The Revenant.
No one saw and liked The Revenant.
Good. Thank you, Brian.
God damn it.
Right. Okay.
Someone Ooh. Needs a fucking smack in the mouth. That's what I
An elbow.
Gonna cut your fucking arm off and beat you with it.
All right. So now that we've devolved into physical threats, let's tell you where we can be found on the internet between now and next week. Bill Graham. Good timing.
At the film stage.
Bill Graham drank the coffee.
Yes.
Nick Newman.
You can find me twitter.com/Nick_Newman, thefilmstage.com, and baiting old racists with stories of fellatio.
Jesus. Amanda Waltz.
You can find me at Media Waltz on Twitter and Letterboxd. Yeah.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on Letterboxd at the same. And you can find me on the film stage and my personal site, dearfilm.net. And we have all contributed to the many, myriad, legion posts that the film stage has done for the end of the year. So make sure to check those out. Ensembles, cinematography, double bills. I got to write about Shaun the Sheep and the Tribe as a double bill. So make sure to go check those out, comment on them, and share them around. Until then, join us next week when we talk about our top tens and possibly The Revenant / Carol / Anomalisa. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Join us next time.